Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Nikias, let's hoop it up.
I can't believe you're just adding this into the intro now. Shout out to our Dunker Spot watch party folks. Shout out to, I guess, ChatGPT for also contributing to that one. But
I'm a man of my word. And if I say that, that means we won't talk about choreography or charges or any of that nonsense or travels or anything like that. Because we had, eight playoff games? And we're talking, just, what are we going to do?
I guess we're going to hoof it up. Shameless. Well, yes, let's dismiss all of the charts talk and choreography talk and travel talk and other rule book adjacent things. Let's get into the playoff slate. 8 games, 6.3 of them were good. We're going to go through all 8. We will start with the Saturday slate. The Sixers getting a 20-point win over the Nets, 121-101. You got 26 from Joel Embiid, 23 and 13 assists from James Harden, who knocked down all kinds of step backs in this game. I'll start with a very basic question for you, Steve. What was your story of this game? What was the big thing that stood out to you as you watched this one?
For me, it was the Sixers being ready for Brooklyn's double teams. And the fact that the Sixers were able to hit them over and over and over again. Because the Nets were doubling Joel Embiid at the elbow in the post. The Sixers were ready for it. They were moving the ball. They were moving their bodies. They worked to keep the advantage. I thought Tobias Harris was aggressive as well. I thought Joel Embiid did a really good job of knowing when to get the ball out, but also mixing in reposts, reseals, catching and attacking before the double can come. Mm-hmm. So when he's able to do that, it's really hard for Brooklyn to get their hands on it, and it just became an automatic for Philadelphia. So that was the big one for me. The non-Embiid lineup being able to hold up offensively was also key. I think they got some good things out of there. And then I think defensively, Philadelphia did what they wanted to do. They were able to play drop. They were able to make the Nets prove it. They were able to stay at home. And even though Mikal Bridges was losing his mind, they were still like, this is fine.
Yeah.
We're not really going to move it. We might throw a switch at you every now and then. Here's a quick hedge. But other than that, have a blast. And those two factors are very interesting.
Yeah, I think one on the Embiid front, I respected how aggressive and how committed Brooklyn was to saying, hey, Joel, not you. You are not dropping 35. You're not dropping 40. We are going to make sure we get the ball out of your hands. But you mentioned the post coming from the middle of the floor, coming into mid post. Even there was a possession early in the first quarter where he just catches the ball on the 3-point line. And Brooklyn's like, nope, let's go ahead and trap. Let's do this. I thought the double teams were also interesting. I think you pointed this out during the watch party that a lot of the doubles were just coming from that opposite wing, regardless of where Joel was. A lot of times the double was coming off of James Harden. And I was like, this is interesting. Like, you look at it on paper, James Harden can shoot. You don't want to help off a good shooter if you can help it. And it felt like Brooklyn was making the bet that, hey, if we help off of James, one, depending on who Joel passes it to first, they may not get it to James fast enough. And beyond that, we don't think James is going to take these catch-and-shoot jumpers in rhythm. He's good at them, but he has been passing those up for years now. So I think that's a fair gamble for us to make. But ultimately, as you said, Brooklyn, Philadelphia was able to figure it out. Joel Embiid, the timing of even when the attack after the double came, like sometimes he just accepted, made the kick, and then play out of that. Other times it's a catch, an immediate turn, baseline, and it's a drive to get to the free throw line that way. So I just thought he managed that as well as you could. And from there, like, I just wonder where Brooklyn kind of goes from here defensively. Like, is this just a matter of, this is the game plan, we just have to execute it better? Or do you see any shifts coming from them on that front?
Well, this is the tough part. If you are going to sell out to take something away in the playoffs, you have committed to that. And so this isn't even the escalation of a game plan or them, like, they've already hit it on the head. Do you trust that going forward? This is when it gets tricky in the playoffs. Do you just keep doubling automatically and hope, okay, we can rotate better? Hopefully, they're not making as many shots. Because underratedly enough, Philadelphia made them pay over and over again. Maybe the passes aren't coming out as quick. Maybe the ball's not moving. Maybe they're not driving and keeping the advantage. Can we keep bogging them down? because ultimately they don't necessarily have an answer for Joel Embiid. So if you take the doubles away, are you just hoping that they just throw it to Embiid a bunch and maybe other people get involved? But how sustainable is that? Like, so I feel like they would have to, they may make Philadelphia prove it again.
That makes sense. And to that point, it was a historic three-point shooting first half for Philadelphia, at the very least. I think 13 made threes was their highest made three total in the first half of a playoff game since 2002, I believe was the stat shown during the broadcast. So I can understand saying, hey, maybe De'Anthony Melton isn't going to do this again. Tobias Harris, maybe you're not going to do this, or you're not going to be as decisive. And so I'm probably with you, like I expect them to stick with it. On the Brooklyn point, one, was very proud of how Mikal Bridges played, particularly in that first half. That man was absolutely cooking. Two, it was still a bit concerning that even with him doing that, it was still very much, we're keeping this 2-on-2. We're not bending it. And what also stood out, like part of this was just, I think a lot of this was just baked into the coverage they were playing. Brooklyn was doubling a lot. Philadelphia keeping things 2-on-2. The Sixers didn't just outshoot Brooklyn from three. They took 14 more attempts as well. And I think when you're already at this kind of like top end talent disparity, Mikal's very good. He's not James Harden, and he definitely isn't Joel Embiid. You have to get the margin somewhere. You have to shift the math to you in some kind of way. Getting more threes up is going to be the easiest way for them to do that. They can't afford to not only lose the percentage battle, but also lose the attempt battle. I guess on the... Actually, I'll stick with Philly on this one. James Harden was very good in this game. Any concern at all about what he did inside the arc against Brooklyn in this game?
No. He showed a willingness to drive. He went to the step back too. It was the control for me that made me say, okay, he's ready to play.
Okay.
It didn't feel forced. It felt like those are the shots he wanted. I did want to circle back to something you said with Brooklyn on the threes, right?
Okay.
Part of it is like, you want to take more, but for Brooklyn, they need to generate more threes. They've got to be able to generate more looks. You think about it. The Nets shot 55% in that game.
From the floor, and yeah.
Philadelphia was just like, cool. do you know how tough that is to swallow? And so for me, it's like, how do they open things up offensively? Do they start to attack Philadelphia's wings and guards? Is that something? Do they go matchup hunting? And hopefully they can get to drive and kick from there. They sprinkled it in game one. Philadelphia added some more switching to their credit, but they also still helped. So it was like, well, I don't know what to do. And then with Mikal Bridges, he made all those shots until Joel Embiid switched one time. And it was like, oh, that's a thing that can happen as well. So it's just like, Brooklyn's going to have to toggle the right buttons. They're going to have to get Dinwiddie going. They're going to have to find a way to get to their drive and kick, open some things up for Cam Johnson. I think there's enough offensively for them, but if you shoot that well and that's still the result, it's tough.
It's very tough indeed. And I guess on the Brooklyn front, like I wonder what they shift offensively, because it's easy for me to say, hey, just take more threes. But to your point, you have to open those up. I do wonder on that front, do they try to hit Embiid a little bit more? Do we see screen him and then go into a pick and roll? Doesn't have to be Spain, but something just to get him moving. I mentioned earlier, there was a possession, I would say midway through the first quarter, Cam Johnson gets an off-screen three on the left wing. It's like, hey, can you loot? Embiid's going to be in a drop, more than likely. He's not going to be switching off-ball stuff. Are there pockets you can attack there as a way to just generate some threes and get some looks there? I think ultimately a lot of this is just going to be they have to play better. I don't think the double teams were bad defensively for them, but there's just going to have to be some cleaner closeouts on some of those. And then offensively, like they're going to need more from Spencer Dinwiddie than they got in that game. It's hard to ask for more from Mikal Bridges, but like there were a couple of possessions where they went guard hunting. They went guard pick and roll, got two to the ball, and Mikal didn't necessarily handle that well. And so if he does get the extra attention, and ultimately that's what you want for Brooklyn, we want a way to scramble Philadelphia if we can, you have to make sure you nail those opportunities too. Because if it's like game one to where, okay, we'll sprinkle in this switch, we'll sprinkle in two to the ball right here. If it's a turnover, Philly's just like, okay, cool. We got that answer right on the test. Let's go back to our base. Let's make them prove it again and make them make us move again. If you can't get to that point, Brooklyn is going to be in a world of trouble. We've I guess, jumped into a little bit of adjustment talk. Is there anything in particular that you're looking for in game two from either side?
I mean, for Philadelphia, it sounds boring, but you have to keep doing it. you can't let the success of game one influence the next game. You have to continue to execute offensively, share the ball, and you got to be as locked in as you were defensively in game one. You need that effort, you need that activity. Again, for Brooklyn, it's just executing your defense better and finding the seams offensively to where maybe you can get Philadelphia to put two on the ball. Maybe that opens something up for you. Or maybe you get to drive and kick against the wings. That opens something up for you. It's just working to be better on both ends of the floor. And for Philadelphia, you can't get bored with success.
Yeah, the decisiveness for Philadelphia in particular is going to have to continue to perk up. Like, I don't expect them to shoot as often or as well from three as they did in game one. But like, there's a certain level they can hit. They just can't allow those openings to close up if Brooklyn is going to continue to double team. A quick Brooklyn defense question. Do you anticipate them sprinkling in zone at all heading into game two? Is that something that you feel like they can go to? Or do you think it's mostly going to be the switching plus the double?
I mean, they could to try and break the rhythm. I mean, maybe more with the non-Embiid lineups. But if I'm going zone, what's stopping Joel Embiid from just standing right there and catching the ball?
Yeah. And that's what you can do when you can knock down mid-range shots at the clip that Joel Embiid can. This is just a tough series for Brooklyn. Any closing thoughts before we move to the next game?
No.
Ah, okay. Well, then we can move to the Boston Celtics beating the Atlanta Hawks 112-99 in a game that really wasn't that close. There was a fourth quarter run in which Atlanta was able to chip it down to, I think, 14 or 12. And Boston immediately responded. So that stayed at a double-digit affair. 29 for Jaylen Brown, 25 and 11 for Jason Tatum, 24, 5 and 7 for Derek White in this one. Steve, what was your primary takeaway from this Hawks Celtics game?
The playoffs, styles make fights, stories are all different. There's a margin for victory for each team. Boston showed, hey, if these things happen, we win. Hey, Trae Young, DeJounte Murray, you guys want to go 15 for 43? High five us.
We'll take that W, yeah.
Like, it's if you go down the checklist, oh, Boston's playing defense. Oh, Boston's playing with pace and tempo, and they're moving the ball, and they're driving. And, oh, Trae Young is not making shots. And, oh, it's DeAndre Hunter one-on-one against Marcus Smart. And, oh, Al Horford's in a drop. Oh, we're not getting in the paint and bending their defense and getting paint touches. Well, we're not going to win that way.
Looks up at scoreboard. Yeah. It just, for me, I don't want to say surprised, because we both know what Boston's defensive personnel is, and we know what that defense looks like when they are locked in. But I found myself a little bit just in awe of how unbothered they were against the Trae pick and rolls. Because Trae is so good, so dynamic as a scorer, so dynamic as a passer. And for what felt like 95% of the game, Boston was like, you know what? We're just going to keep this 2-on-2. Actually, we trust Derek White to navigate these screens, and boy, did he. Al Horford in the drop, we're not going to give up easy stuff. We're not going to give up the lob over the top. I will say Atlanta tried to mix in some guy in the corner lifting up to the wing just to empty out that corner. There was one lob to, I want to say it was Clint Capella in that first quarter. Got one out of that. But for the most part, it's like, Trae beat us with floaters. You got Derek White, rear view contestant, you got Al Horford right here. And we're not giving you the lob or the dump off. Have fun. The ball swings to DeJounte Murray. Like, hey, Wendy's drives against Jaylen Brown. He's strong. Like, throughout the podcast, I've talked about, like, what it's kind of inconsistent with Jaylen Brown off the ball. You just tell him, hey, just sit in a stance and guard this guy. There aren't too many guys better on the ball at the wing position than Jaylen Brown. DeJounte didn't have much fun. And, like, even when he got dropped, it's mid-range pull-ups that, one, he's comfortable with, but two, Boston is also very comfortable with. Like, okay, if you're not going to get shots at the rim, and ultimately, as has been the story for Atlanta pretty much up until Quinn Snyder got there, and they still wanted at a different level, this isn't a Hawks team that takes a ton of threes either. And so it was apparent very early on when Trae wasn't making shots, they're like, oh, not only is Boston just okay with keeping this 2-on-2, if Trae ain't making shots, we don't have much to talk about here. And that game got ugly very, very quickly.
It did. And that's where Boston dictated terms. And not to tie it into Brooklyn, Philadelphia, but Atlanta's in a position where they have to now perform at a certain level to make Boston even shift, make them adjust. If they are saying, hey, this is drop, you have to make these over and over again, how many do you have to make before they make a shift? Like, we're talking about this without Boston doing a lot of the quote-unquote matchup bending. where we can just mess with you that way and switch. Al Horford in the drop also allows Robert Williams to be in the drop. And Robert Williams in the drop is pretty good.
We got to talk about how good Robert Williams was in that game. Good Lord.
So that's where if Boston is able to move their defense into the dictating phase, it gets really tricky. Because this is something that we talked about pre-series. If DeJounte Murray is only going to be a pull-up person, it gets interesting. And if Trae Young is only going to have the choice of pull up three with someone next to me or driving down the lane for a floater or hoping I get a late lob, What else is there? Where's the driving kick? Where are the assists coming from?
Not much. It also doesn't help. Like, I guess I'll just pose this as a question because I think your X factor heading into this one for Atlanta was John Collins. One of your X factors was John Collins and his usage and being able to affect the game offensively. I will say game one, frankly, was not it in terms of the usage, in terms of the overall production. And like for me, as I was like getting prepped together and some suggestions for Atlanta moving into game two. If this is the way that John Collins is going to be used in this particular series, I would just rather see more Sadiq Bey at the four. And I don't think Sadiq Bey is as good of a defender as John Collins. Not that he's a world beater, but there's at least a size, some rebounding. There's some weak side rim protection that you can get sometimes from John Collins. But ultimately, this is a team that needs to spread Boston out some kind of way. And kind of similar to the Brooklyn-Philly thing, it may just have to be a math ordeal to a certain extent. And it's going to be hard to do that against Boston, who ranked top five in three-point rate this year. But like, you got to give yourself a chance. And if you're just going to use John Collins as a spacer with a very random, hey, a small guard's guarding you, we'll dump it to you here with 8 on the clock. Like, Sadiq Bey can give you a mid-post touch. And he's much more willing and better shooting the three ball than John Collins is. Am I crazy for like having that thought bubble pop up?
I mean, I don't want to call you crazy. That's rude. The problem is who's setting Sadiq Bey up?
Yeah.
Or does he now just become a person who will do this a little bit more than the other guy?
I mean, that's what it feels like for me. Cause like John Collins wasn't a super active screener in game one. And so this is where I think ideal world, you find a way to get John Collins more involved because I think he's better and I think he can give you some stuff, particularly on the interior. My train of thought is just like, if it's going to be primary spacer role, you have a better spacer on your bench. And it may just be worth exploring that more if this is the way you're going to use John.
I think the counter would be, let's not use John just as that.
Yeah.
that's going to be where I go personally.
Yeah,
I just think that Atlanta has to find a way to keep pressure on Boston. It can't be this level of quick shots against this type of Boston defense, especially if Atlanta's defense is going to be what it was. Mm-hmm. So we talk about the offense all day. Atlanta's defense was running around in that game. Boston had them in a headlock. The ball movement, able to turn the corner, multiple people, whether it was Tatum, Brown, Smart, they were able to get rolls. Just off a pin down, Robert Williams able to get a roll and a lob. Can't be that.
Yeah, they just land getting beat back door on some stuff. I'm just like, hey, man, how y'all? You can't have all that happen at once while also not scoring at a high clip. So that was just kind of tough. I don't have any more thoughts on this one. I need Atlanta to play better. I think their fans obviously want them to play better. If you're Boston, like, you just got to keep hitting those notes. Keep Atlanta constricted, switch when you need to, bog them down. As long as the decision-making continues to be there for Boston and if the shot makers at that level, like, you're going to be in a pretty good spot. Let's go to the mud real quick. The Knicks getting a game one victory over the Cleveland Cavaliers, stealing home court, 101-97, 27 points in a foul trouble field game for Jalen Brunson, particularly in the first half, 19-10 for Julius Randle, 17-10 off the bench for Josh Hart, including a step back three late in the fourth, late in the shot clock, where I feel like everyone in the arena is like, you got to be kidding me right now. Big games for Donovan Mitchell, 38 points and 8 assists for him. Darius Garland with 17 points, 1 assist in that one. Double-double for Jared Allen, 8 points and 11 boards for Evan Mobley. Where do we start with this Cleveland game, this Cleveland Knicks game? What were your big takeaways from this one?
I start with a salute, a shout-out to the New York Knicks defense. They stood out to me. They were locked in. Game plan wise, they executed everything they needed to. I thought they did an excellent job of showing help early and often. And I think to Cleveland's credit, they did try a lot of different things in pick and roll, and the Knicks were not cooperating with any of it. Hey, you want to go empty corner? You want to empty the whole side out? You want to space Donovan? You want to go pistol? You want to screen into it? Cool. Our help is going to be pulled over early. If we have to, we'll show help from the strong side. And we're just not giving you what you want. So if you go back and look at that game, you can find so many clips where the roll is happening. Jared Allen is spaced at the dunker spot and Mitchell Robinson's like, well, I'm out. Or a short roll is coming and Mitchell Robinson, well, I'm here. He was incredible with his help in the paint to disrupt Cleveland's flow. I think like just being able to stay that consistent with your help was massive. They literally just told Cleveland, we don't think you have enough people to beat us. I do not think you do. I thought they were active and physical, which took away Cleveland's off-ball actions. You saw the impact of having Grimes, having Barrett, having Hart, being able to use those guys to guard both of Cleveland's guards and Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland. And now you take some things off of the menu for Cleveland's offense. We're now, okay, you want to get to your off-ball stuff? Sweet. It's going to take 8 more seconds. And we're going to be right here the entire time.
Yeah.
And if you do get off, yeah, here's a stunt. Here's some more help. Just to remind you that fifth guy's over there. And then I thought they did an excellent job of mixing their coverages. Something you spoke about was, hey, are they going to take away Darius Garland? And they really worked to. But they mixed things up, which I thought was the key. With their fours, Julius Randle, Obi Toppin, at the level trap, were active. With their fives, we're still going to be at a drop. How do you catch a rhythm if you're Darius Garland? And depending on who's in the action, you have to deal with size of the rim, help coming from somewhere, and size pursuing and navigating that screen. They never let him get comfortable, which is something Cleveland has to fix going into game two. They gave Donovan Mitchell the drop, which I didn't expect. I got to take my L on that. They got to be careful, though. I don't know how many of those you want to give up if it's a closer game, but to each their own. And just the consistency they had taking that fourth or fifth guy from Cleveland's lineup and saying, nope, not you. Mm-mm. Hey, Evan Mobley, Jared Allen, you guys got to prove it.
Yeah, and you've been sprinkling in the question throughout the regular season, like, hey, where are you at on these bigs, particularly on the offensive end? It's like, well, I trust both of them as decision makers. I think they're both really good finishers. Like, there are going to be some matchups just from a spacing perspective where they get tough, but like, I don't feel bad about them. And it's key not to get, you know, not to overreact to game ones. But like, man, basically everything you had questions about felt like it popped up in that game one. Where it's like, all right, cool. 1-4 pick and roll, Evan Mobley short roll, and then it's brief hesitation and then go. And it's like, hey, this is a bunch of space. Maybe don't take that extra dribbling to the contest against Mitchell Robinson. You don't want to do that. And then sometimes like, hey, you don't want to rush that. Like, it's fine. Like, let's survey it a little bit. And I think that speaks to one, how keyed in New York's defense was. Like, props go to them before any kind of slander or anything. Their defense was keyed in. And you mentioned the 1-4 pick and rolls being trapped or the 2-4 pick and rolls being trapped. To bounce off your point, it's a lot easier to do that when, okay, I can just sit home here. You're not getting this empty dump off. They're trying to put a core on the strong side here. All right, that's fine. We'll send some help. And if he's in the weak side, well, we're definitely peeling in. And if you try to screen at all, we don't really care about it because ultimately there's a whole bunch of size in the primary action. We don't think you're going to make this skip. Not because you're not good enough to make the pass, but you are so much in this phone booth when trying to navigate this and when trying to drive. And now you have pressure coming into your face as well as you drive downhill. We don't care. And I will say to the Donovan Mitchell point, one, the shot making was wild, but two, he kind of had to just get a little quicker on the trigger with the way he was being defended sometimes. And like, that's the kind of balance that I'm going to be tracking into game two. Because to your point, like, they gave him drop. They did have their bigs creep up a little bit closer to the level as the game went on, but it still wasn't a full blown, we are going to trap you or we're going to be fully at the level. A lot of those pull up threes that he made were shots that New York probably feels pretty good about. Like, okay, if he's taking pull-ups, these are the type of pull-ups that we want him to take. We don't want the high ball screen 30 feet from the basket. He's pulling up from 26 feet. Our big man is at the free throw line. That kind of drop. We're not giving him those. He's not going to see those in this series. if we can get up to the 3-point line or like a step or two below that, and the contestant's there, we don't worry about fouling them at all. I think they're okay with that shot diet. And Donovan Mitchell shot very well from three in that game, but like, that's just kind of tough. Cleveland has to figure out a way to get Darius Garland going. And I think it was smart for them. Similar thing, 1-4 pick and rolls, he's getting trapped. 1-5, higher at the level, help behind that. The shot making has to be there from the others. Okoro didn't have it. They end up closing with Chetty. And even with Chetty on the floor, much better shooter. And he made some big plays for them in that fourth quarter. New York didn't guard him like someone that could shoot like that, which is interesting to me. I didn't expect Chetty to be in, if he burns his tip our cap, territory. And if he's there, that's problematic. Also, where was Caris LeVert in this one? I think they definitely needed the secondary creation from him with some of the overloads they were seeing offensively. And he just wasn't, the impact wasn't there.
Sorry, Cavs fans. You need Caris LeVert this series. You need him pretty bad. I think there was one possession I remember where he had the ball. New York was in a drop. He was able to drive and kick. And I was like, oh, he's kicking it to Mitchell. And now Garland can attack a scramble and close out. Oh, they need Caris LeVert. He's going to have to play. I think to your point, Cleveland has to find their lineups. In the regular season, I like them being able to go small because they needed to in the playoffs. And now you see they really need to in the playoffs. And they have to not only find a way to space the floor, space the Knicks. Those guys are Okoro, LeVert, Chetty. They have to be able to make shots or drive closeouts or cut. You just have to do something to make New York pay for the aggressive help they're showing. And yet you're going to have to be able to score because defensively, do you open up question marks? Can you rebound? You need to open up things for your bigs and hopefully they can get into a rhythm if you're smaller. You need your bigs to perform offensively. They have to be factors. It changes the game. If Mobley and Allen are better on the roll and finishing, I think that's a difference maker.
Yeah.
I think Darius Garland should be better in game two now that he at least has a feel for what they're going to do to him. And we'll see if Cleveland's able to kind of manipulate the spacing, manipulate their actions to take advantage of the Knicks' help. There's another problem for Cleveland, though.
What you got?
Jalen Brunson.
Quite good.
That's why you go get him. And my thing about this in this series, the control and the comfort that Jalen Brunson had in that game. His ability to match up Hunt and play with the second unit or to take pressure off Julius Randle. So, hey, we don't have to just throw it in the post and hope something happens. Putting Garland and Mitchell in action late in games. Getting to a spot, letting it fly. What the Cleveland can't afford to have happen is for Jalen Brunson to be comfortable in pick and roll against the bigs and in pick and roll against all their guards and in one-on-one against their wings. Got to take something off the table.
Yeah. And to that point, like, I wonder just how much, I guess, moving forward in the series for both teams, like, how much mismatch hunting do we see with those guards? Because to Cleveland's point, like, they did try to get Brunson in action and try to open up some things there. And they were able to get some pretty decent stuff out of it. So I would imagine they try to hammer that home a little bit more. And on the New York side, they absolutely said, hey, Darius, Donovan, let's see what you can do, bud. So that's going to be a fun mini battle to keep track of moving forward. On the adjustment front, anything that you would like to see differently from Cleveland? Anything specific you'd like to see from them in game two?
I think they're just going to get creative. They're going to have to get creative with their spacing. They're going to have to understand that who the Knicks are trying to help off of. They found a couple little bits and pieces in game one where Darius Garland pins before the screen. Julius Randle has to come up. Now the help's coming from RJ Barrett on the weak side instead of Robinson. New York fixed it pretty quick, but those are the little tweaks they're going to have to do. If you know New York is helping, you need to find a way to use that to your advantage. You need to get them on the move a little bit more. They can't load up to this extent. And mostly it's going to have to be ready to be physical, be ready to cut, use the denials against them. And this is a play through multiple options type series. You're going to have to get the tempo up and grind them a little bit and be comfortable.
All right, I got you. Like, I think on the Cleveland front, I would like to see if they're going to hide Jalen Brunson or Isaac Okoro, but use them as a screener a little bit more. I think you'd be able to get some stuff out of that. Or at the very least, like, make that a 3-man action. Let's get a Okoro screening and then let's get our big screening. Let's see if we can navigate some stuff there and get New York's defense moving a little bit. Other than that, this feels very much like Garland has. He has the feel for it. We just need you to play a little bit better. Evan Mobley in particular, like, you just have to finish shots in the mid-range area or lower. Like, you just have to be able to nail those short roll opportunities. Like, I don't feel like it was bad from him. The scoring portion, it just wasn't there. He's going to have to be better. Processing, there's some slight hesitation, but overall didn't feel bad. But, like, this is how small the margins are. And considering how much the Knicks were trying to restrict space, it's just got to be better.
You know, the wild part is the Knicks offense wasn't that great.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was not.
It wasn't that great, but the margin for error they had because of how good their defense was. Was it like if they are able to execute and play better on that end?
Yeah, like, wasn't the most efficient game for Julius Randle, first game back in a few weeks now after the ankle injury. The Knicks, as much as I parade their bench, and I think their bench overall was pretty good in this one. I saw Isaiah Hartenstein made big plays, talked a little bit about Josh Hart. Very quiet night for Emmanuel Quickley in game one.
Interesting. He came off the bench, right?
He did.
Oh.
Ah, I see. I see what's going on here. Okay, well, let's move to the most electric game of Saturday night slate. The Kings, a 126-123 victory over the Warriors to get game one. 38 points for De'Aaron Fox, 32 for Malik Monk, 30 from Steph, 21 from Klay Thompson, 17 apiece from Andrew Wiggins and Jordan Poole. We'll talk about those two a little bit more. Steve, what were your primary takeaways from that exciting game?
How did we get dueling box and ones, and why was one of them to take away Malik Monk?
Well, I have one answer, but I'll let you go first.
For me, one, this is going to be an incredible series. I don't know what the outcome is going to be quite yet, but this feels like the one in the first round. A couple things that stood out to me. Steph Curry high pick and roll is going to be a problem for Sacramento. I don't know exactly when, but that jumped off the screen to me watching the tape back. Sabonis has to come up high. If it's Looney, you might be okay because it's a long roll for him. If Golden State can figure out enough small ball stuff to where it's Draymond rumbling down from that high, what does that open up? Does Steph Curry add the drives, add the threes, add the pull-ups? How much do the Warriors want to tap that button? Because we've seen them flip a series saying, hey, we're just going to run empty corner pick and roll.
All right, fine.
Sorry, Houston. We're just going to run that, and that's going to be that. So what does that open up for Golden State? I thought it was a game where both teams felt comfortable with the pace and the tempo. I think both teams give each other a margin for error when it comes to quick shots, turnovers, so that's fun. What stood out to me was the space that Kevon Looney and the Golden State Warriors gave DeMontos Sabonis. They said, hey, man, big fella,
come on down.
we'll see you in the paint. So I thought Kevon Looney did an incredible job of playing off. He was playing back. He was waiting for Sabonis to initiate contact. He was contesting almost every time in the paint. The secret is the Warriors' wings would also come in and fly by, which is a very little thing. But when you think about Sabonis, his counter is, well, I'm just going to hit you really hard and then pump fake and then go up. And all of a sudden you just see like a GP2 or a Dante just jump and swing at air. It's like, ah.
What you doing over here?
So that was a little thing. I thought Draymond being able to guard him one-on-one with some of those second unit lineups was also interesting because it's like, well, no. Let me show you what I did to Jokic last year. The secondary part about that space they gave Sabonis was it really allowed the Warriors to turn up defensively their activity against the handoffs. They were really getting into bodies. They were really working to deny. They were trying to fight over. If they were cuts, they knew they had someone back there. And the handoffs are so important to Sacramento. So I want to see if Sacramento can adjust there. The counter is you gave a lot of space to De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk. And those two seem to enjoy the space that they had.
Boy, did they.
And Malik Monk, whether it was from three, from two, he was doing great. But De'Aaron Fox was able to lead the dance. I don't know how much you want to let that happen in this series.
It starts with one, shout out to the Kings for getting their first playoff win in a very long time. And that crowd was electric. And just on a personal note, very glad that I got to hear Mark Jones and Doris Burke on that call. That was a game tailor-made for them. I enjoyed it. the Warriors defense is kind of where I landed, especially at the rewatch, because the drives from Sacramento had them fighting for their lives. And you just made the note about how they tried to safeguard against Sabonis and the aggression against the handoffs. And they have been the most handoff heavy team in the NBA. I think I was looking it up this morning. Sabonis logged 15 handoffs in that game, which is well below where he normally is. But you normally get 15 between Sabonis plus Herter in a game. If Sacramento can just say, you know what, fine, we will just drive the basketball, and the Warriors don't have an answer for that, that's going to be very, very, very problematic. I was a little surprised we didn't see more of like Draymond or De'Aaron, but I just look at the wings. Like I think we can all recall the highlight in the fourth quarter where Klay Thompson gets matched up with De'Aaron Fox and Dance Dance Revolution ensued. Andrew Wiggins didn't have much fun.
Dance Dance Revolution, he says.
It was kind of tough. It was kind of tough. But like, that's what you can't allow. Like Klay had a tough time. Andrew Wiggins had a tough time. Jordan Poole really had a tough time. And this is before like he had the ankle tweak late in the third quarter. They have to find a way to contain the drives, because it's just going to be a different way for the Kings to generate the movement that they want to get from the handoffs and stuff anyway. Like ultimately, they just want to get you to make a mistake, scramble your defense. We're going to get a shot at the rim, or we're going to kick it out and get a three out of it. If it just becomes fine, we'll remove the fluff, one screen, or just clear it out. We go, and now you got to help. It's just going to start a chain all over again. So that's the big thing that popped for me in that one. Like the containment just was not there for Golden State.
Which is interesting because going into the playoffs, you had that concern with Sacramento and it got flipped in this one.
Yeah.
I guess I'll ask the question. How important or do you believe in Golden State's ability to get paint touches against Sacramento, either via the drive or the cut?
But I do to an extent, and I think to your earlier point about the high pick and rolls from Steph, like I also wanted to note just how high those picks were being set. This is darn, like Steph crosses half court, here comes Kevon Looney. And it's like, well, that's one way to open up a runway, because that is a lot for Steph to just pull up on a dime and get a three if necessary. He can also just get all the way downhill, and you got to send some help somewhere. And Golden State is so good at relocating when you send help. That's a way for them to get that done. But this also kind of brings me to the importance of, I guess, what was their second unit in game one with Andrew Wiggins and Jordan Poole coming off the bench. They need the rim pressure from those two. And this is Wiggins' first game back. So I just have a general, when can he play 30 minutes question swirling around in my head, just from like a conditioning standpoint, because they're going to need his defense. And they're also just going to need the rim pressure that he can provide on the second side. And this is also what kind of complicates the Jordan Poole thing. Because for me, it's like, well, this defense isn't great. When they go small, he's very much the guy they're going to target. They have other defenders, cut his minutes. But then I was like, okay, wait a minute. Who does Sacramento worry about as a driver? It's Steph, and then who exactly? Like, Clay's been very good. He's not a fearsome driver in the eyes of Sacramento. Dante can beat a scrambling defense, but like, he's not a fiercer driver for them. Jonathan Kuminga has the juice as a driver. But I was joking with you before we started the show. It's like, second unit, they had Alex Len on him. And it's like, I think it was Len and Trey Lyles in the front court. They just put Alex Len on. It's like, hey, do stuff. They need Jordan Poole. One, he's good. But two, like that specific skill set with the rim pressure to take some pressure off of Steph, take some pressure off of Klay when they're out there together or just when one of those guys on the bench, they need that. And if they can't get the rim pressure from him because of the ankle or because the defense doesn't allow him to play that much, it does get a lot tougher for Golden State, or I'll say it just gets tougher for Golden State to generate those kind of looks off of drives.
No, I mean, watching it, I had the feeling Jordan Poole not only has to like score, he has to drive, but that's where it ties into, okay, can Golden State find an action that is going to get Sacramento to scramble? And now all they need is a cut or a post split or a stagger or a roll to now. That's where we get to scrambling. Now we get to a little bit of drive and kick, and now we can generate the shots we want. That's the part I'm looking at, where, okay, Golden State needs this. Can they get it in a different way?
I got you on that front. Like, this is just a really fun game. I've just, my mind really goes to these second units or these hybrid units for the Warriors. I think Gary Payton II winds up being a lot more important in the series than even I anticipated. And I knew his on-ball defense was going to be important, but they really need him. And to that point, I wonder what the offensive usage is going to be like for him. Do they use him more as a screener? Because I think you can still get some good stuff out of that if you're Golden State. Again, the pool stuff is pretty obvious. Kuminga, under 10 minutes in this game. Like, I do wonder, like, what is his viability? Because if they can't find the lineups for that to hit, then that just gives more room for Sacramento to say, hey, we're just driving the basketball. Let's have some fun here. Any, like, major adjustments that you'd like to see from Sacramento or Golden State heading into game two?
No, I mean, nothing major. I think for Golden State, it's just going to be, can we tighten things up defensively? And then can we continue to generate the kind of shots that we want to get? Do we feel more comfortable with the lineups that we're throwing out there at different times? Can we continue to bother Sabonis? Can we disrupt their handoffs? Can we force them into some of this one-on-one type stuff that they can do, but maybe they don't want to do as often? And then if I'm Sacramento, can we defend better? Can we handle the Curry pick and roll better? Can we continue to keep our base? Are we going to open shots up? Are we ready for Steph Curry to have a better game?
It seems hard to believe.
But yeah, I think if I'm Golden State, I'm looking at Malik Monk and saying, not you, not again.
We're not letting this happen, pal. Also, a quick second unit note for Sacramento's side. Davion Mitchell, very important minutes for him. His on-ball defense was wild in that game, and they're going to need him. The fact that the Kings were able to go with three guard lineups against this Warriors group intrigued the heck out of me.
Again, these are two teams that are pointing at each other and be like, hey, thanks. We can try this.
That's pretty true. For me, like, I would still like to see a little bit more exploration with the handoffs. So I guess it's kind of a general, hey, can you defend Kevin Herter? Can you defend Keegan Murray? Can you stay that attached in game two as well as you were in game one? We'll see. Like, force the issue there a little bit, especially if Sabonis is going to get that kind of room. And even on that front, because Sabonis didn't shoot well from the field in that game, there were still some shots that he normally makes that he did not make, that he didn't in game one. The Warriors just have to kind of keep an eye on that one for sure.
You did not want to give Kevon Looney his flowers.
No, Kevon Looney played very well in the game. I'm just saying, like, some of the hook, like, Sabonis makes contested shots in the paint. It is what he does. You don't shoot 60% from the field by just getting great looks with that kind of usage. You make some toughies. Sabonis didn't make the tough ones in that one. And that is a credit to what Kevon Looney did, but also, like, those can go in game two. So just keeping an eye on that one. Beyond that, like, I just, perimeter defense for Golden State just has to be better. I am kind of curious with Sacramento sprinkling in some of the switches. And I think this is something that you hit on during the watch party, or not, I guess on your timeline rather, about Sabonis being able to switch sometimes. How viable does that become? And what does that say about maybe some of the lineup combination that Golden State has out there? If they feel like, okay, we can switch them and send help from here if all else fails, and if they can funnel shots in that way. So I am intrigued on that front. I think that is all I have on that one. We can move to the Lakers and the Grizzlies, a 128-112 win for the Lakers in game one. We obviously have to keep an eye on what happens with Ja Morant. He was injured during that game. Looks like it's going to be unlikely that he's available for game two. So that certainly changes some things. But in regards to game one, what was the thing that popped out for you in that one?
Everything popped out for me. This series has had me in a chokehold the whole time. And now we got Rui Hachimura and Austin Reeves losing their minds. This is a fun series. I think the fact that Rui was able to make Jaren Jackson Jr. pay stood out to me. I think the poise that Austin Reeves showed in the fourth stood out to me. I think it ties to the larger deal. And Ja being hurt doesn't help with this. Because even in that game one, it was so back and forth where each team kind of displayed, ooh, this is what we can do. And they also displayed, hey, this is what we absolutely cannot afford to have happen. Mm-hmm. And it turned into just like swinging left and right. And for it to kind of end in the way it did, with basically Rui saying, hey, I'm going to make you pay, Jaren. You want to help in Rome? I'm going to make you pay. That's what we're going to do. After asking, hey, can the Lakers survive these smaller lineups against Jaren? Was funny. What stood out to you? Is there any one thing that stood out to you in this one?
I think the big thing pre-injury, I guess we have to throw that note in there, was how the Lakers defended Ja Morant. And I think we went into it like, hey, who's going to get the Ja assignment? Will it be Austin Reeves and you ask him to duck under? Will it be D'Lo you ask him to duck under? Do we see them press the Jared Vanderbilt button? They did press the Jared Vanderbilt button, and they also had him fighting over screens. And I was like, huh, this is odd. And not only was he fighting over screens, there was also like a full court pressure type beat that didn't feel like full court pressure half the time because Ja just kind of jogged up the court. And I was like, well, I don't know if I like that. And we talked about that during the watch party. But it's like, okay, they are putting size on him, which we expected, but like fighting over. And I think the combination of Jared Vanderbilt fighting over and doing a pretty solid job in terms of screen navigation. He is one of the best wing defenders, forward defenders in the NBA. So not a super surprise, but screen navigation was good for him. But that's just a lot of size and recovery stuff on Ja's back. And that combined with if it's AD in the action, he's not quite at the level, but he has the length there to close off space. I was like, huh. This isn't what I thought. I figured it'd just be an under and dare you to chew up the space. But the over plus AD being higher up, I was intrigued.
I see. I see what you're trying to do here, buddy.
What's going on?
You was ready to throw Ja over the top rope.
I was not ready to throw him over the top rope.
Yeah. I can see where this is going.
What does that mean?
We're going to ignore beating the full court pressure and the one-on-one play, the rejects. I see what you're doing. I see what you're doing, pal.
This is so shameless. No, you asked me what stood out to me. The Lakers game plan was interesting to me. And to your point, like Ja did still, he still had some drives. He did have some fun stuff inside the rim before he got hurt. But that was interesting to me.
I had so many usage questions on both sides of the floor. And it's difficult now because Ja's not there. But if Jaren Jackson Jr. is going to be the four to start and LeBron is on him, how are you using Jaren Jackson Jr.? I don't think it can be a straight post-up. I think you need to get Jaren Jackson Jr. involved in some movement. It looked like Rui Hachimura couldn't guard Jaren Jackson Jr. for a large stretch of time in that game. But then it felt like Jaren Jackson Jr. didn't get the ball for a long stretch of that game. And so it's like, how do you handle that? Where do you put him? Does Memphis have enough lineups to do what they want to do? Get away with some of these lineups? Jaren at the five, that's great. If he's in action, where's everyone else? And what are you running? How are you opening things up? So you can see where Memphis is trying to churn and get to different things, but they may not have the lineups to get it done. For the Lakers, if I ever see Anthony Davis being guarded by Santi Aldama and he's just standing for 3 minutes straight, I need the Lakers guards to do the thing.
You had Lakers guards as your X factor in this one. We got to see both sides of the coin in this game.
For a reason. But then again, you saw like little ways that each team was testing each other. LeBron looking at a lineup that had what? Ja Morant, Tyus Jones, Luke Kennard, and Desmond Bane on there at the same time. They've got to be able to find something at a screen and roll with LeBron if Memphis is going to go that small. And it looks like the only pick and roll partner he had was Austin Reeves yesterday. That was the one where it really popped, where, hey, we can play pick and roll, pick and pop. We can get something out of this. But I feel like they left some things on the table.
I'm glad because you started with Jaren. I was going to jump in like, yeah, I had a usage question about one of the Lakers stars and you already got to it. The LeBron usage just felt a little odd for me. And one, it was very cool that he could just kind of chill off the ball late in the fourth quarter just because of what Rui was doing and then what Austin Reeves did to kind of slam the door. Like, that was just fun. A quick stat on that front, Austin Reeves received 25 on-ball picks. That is the seventh most in his NBA career. 22 of those came with LeBron on the court, which is easily a career high in terms of Austin Reeves just getting to do stuff while LeBron was on the floor. Next highest, I think, was 15. So it wasn't close. LeBron very much said, hey, you cooking, you got it. And he delivered to that point. But yeah, on the LeBron front, it's just like there was a possession, I think second quarter ended up being a turnover because LeBron threw a behind-the-back pass that was pretty ill-advised. It was him and it had Rui screening for him. It's like if you're going to do the mismatch hunting thing with LeBron, or if you're just going to go inverted with LeBron as the handler, like use Austin Reeves. Find some better combinations. And if you're going to have LeBron screen for someone, like let's empty the corner for him and make that tougher. It just felt like when they did go to LeBron ball screens, again, it wasn't a super involved on-ball game for him in that regard. But if you're going to go to that, like, make sure it's optimal. You can get more out of this. So I think just, I guess, looking ahead, like, that's something that Lakers can do better regardless of what Ja's status is and regardless of what the match or the lineups are going to be for Memphis. Like, there have to be smarter ways to use LeBron. I would also say on the Memphis front, the fact that I am saying, hey, they could have used LeBron better and you're down a game, that's not great. But I guess even on that flip side, is Jaren having 31, we had usage questions from him, so the fact didn't get better. I looked that up for you, too, because that's something that you noted. Came off of 4 off-ball screens in game one, a little bit below the season average. And, like, none of those were, like, Jaren really coming off of a pin down into the corner or some of the exit screen stuff that they do with him. No staggers for him. You have to vary that up. Like, make LeBron navigate stuff. Or best case scenario, depend if you're going to go stagger with Jaren Jackson Jr., if you have someone small as the second screener, maybe you get a switch there. Maybe you get D'Lo to switch onto him now. Also, just a general Memphis lineup note. You mentioned some of the smaller lineups that they went with. Some of that was just because Dylan Brooks is in foul trouble, and they really can't afford for him to have the foul trouble game. They need him out there. I guess beyond usage stuff with Jaren, is there anything else you'd like to see from Memphis heading into game 2?
Well, I think if there's no Ja, there's going to have to be a lot more ball movement. I think there's got to be a lot more Desmond Bane. I think he's still going to be very important as the player who can bring the Lakers defense up to the level, which can open up the roles for them as someone who can come off movement sets and maybe open up some roles that way. So I'd like to see that, see them move the ball more. On the Lakers side, it's very clear if they can get to drive and kick and they are knocking down shots, the series is right there for them. But it's going to take effort to get to the dribble penetration. So are they going to hit the right notes with empty corners? LeBron and AD going to open things up? They have a template, but they now have to be ready to defend in a different way. So while Ja may be out, this is the Memphis team that has played without him before. This is the Memphis team that may have some more movement without Ja. Are you ready for that?
That's a good point. And before we move on, like, I feel like I just used browser footnote in this one. 22 points, 12 boards, 7 blocks, and 3 steals for Anthony Davis, who is just dominant on both ends of the floor. Also, just glad he's healthy. A little bit of a scare towards the end of the second quarter there. Did come back. So it's, and again, we mentioned this during the preview, Anthony Davis was very good against Memphis in the regular season in the games that he played. And it doesn't feel like Memphis has a great answer for him yet. To the Sunday slate, in which Miami was able to pull off a game one victory, 130 to 117. Giannis did get hurt in that game. As I've seen, there's some optimism from Milwaukee that he's going to be available for game 2. The Heat will not have Tyler Hero, who suffered a broken hand diving for a loose ball, which is obviously not ideal for them. But the Heat got a 13-point win, 35 points and 11 assists for Jimmy Butler, 22-9-7 from Bam in a game that did not feel like he had 22-9-7, but it's neither here nor there. Big game from Kevin Love. Huge game from Chris Middleton in the loss, 33 points and 9 boards. Steve, what stood out to you in this game one win for the Heat?
That of all the teams in the world, this is the Miami Heat that did this to the Bucks defense that I've been talking about all season long and waiting to see who's going to take the space, who's going to make the shots. Miami, 15 threes, huh? 60% from deep. Jimmy Butler wanted to have that game, okay? He did that from the start. I thought Kevin Love was huge. I think, obviously, you hope Giannis is all right. That is a series shifter that we all know about. I think Miami's really going to miss Tyler Hero because this is a series that was kind of built for him. If nothing else, Brooke was going to be in a drop. The space was going to be there to take shots. The decision-making was going to be a little bit simpler. Jimmy Butler against Brooke in the paint was very interesting. The way that he finished, the timing that he had, the force he came out with. Bam didn't figure it out until it felt like in the fourth quarter. But again, they took advantage of the automatics that Milwaukee gave them. What stood out to me was Miami's defense to where they just said, hey, Max Strus, why don't you just guard Brooke Lopez? You just do that, and then we'll help a little bit and, you know, get some switches and pick and roll. Hey, Kyle Lowry, you could just stand next to Brooke Lopez, too. That's fine. We kind of tilt the matchups that way. And then I felt like Kevin Love was very interesting in the sense that he just did his job. Salute to Kevin Love. I come here. I am close to the level. I am going backwards. I'm good. On the other end of the floor, I am letting it fly.
I shoot.
Hey, I am shooting. Brooke Lopez, you going to help? Cool, I'm here. I'll knock down shots. Another thing to keep an eye on, the Jimmy Butler drives when Brooke is not on the floor. Milwaukee can't have that.
Very good stuff from my dear friend Steve Jones Jr. When you mentioned the name of Brook Lopez, something just flipped in my head. And it took me back to the frustration I had watching that game.
The seasoning. Where was the seasoning?
Man, listen. All props due to what Miami was able to pull off on Sunday. I do not understand. Bobby Portis getting what felt like 13 times the post usage that Brook Lopez did while being defended by Max Strus. Not only was he defended by Max Strus, the Heat were switching a ton. And so they would run a ball screen or they have like some kind of ghost action for Max Strus. Gabe Vincent would then switch on to Brook Lopez. And Brook is just spacing. And I'm just like, what on earth are we doing here? I don't understand how you don't exploit that. How do you not force Miami's defense to send help?
Well, don't mean to interrupt, but not only not exploit that, you willingly run action that involves Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo. Like, you go to that side of the court. Continue.
This is year two of the podcast and like year like 2.5 season of NBA stuff on this podcast, man. The Bucks half-court offense has had me in shambles in some way, shape, or form every single postseason we have done this podcast.
I've been telling you, man.
I just don't, I don't get it for the life of me. Brook Lopez is coming off of not just a DPOY caliber season. That man did just about everything well offensively this year. He sprinkled in the random 30-point game. He was shooting well from three. Like, I don't get how you have this. And especially when Giannis went down. Another salute to the shot-making Chris Middleton. And, like, Drew ultimately just didn't have it, particularly with the pull-ups. He's got this 7-foot skill dude. And it's like, actually, no, we're okay. We're just going to keep banging our heads against the wall. That just did not make sense to me. But beyond that, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I'm going to pull out the thing that Bucks fans told me last year. We didn't make any threes. Drew didn't play well. We were still right there.
And that's
sprinkle that in. Sprinkle that in. Continue.
Okay. No, that's very much true. Miami had one of their best three-point shooting performances of the season. Milwaukee, to put it kindly, did not have one of their best three-point shooting performances of the season. In fact, it was very bad. And so variance is the name of the game. Miami very much won that battle. But you've been doing this long enough. You've been doing this with me long enough. The process matters to me. If you are doing good things and you miss shots, that's just basketball sometimes. It's also more frustrating that Milwaukee was able to put up 117 in spite of themselves in this game, even with the bad three-point shooting. In fact, the fact that the three-pointer wasn't falling for them is even more incentive to go in anyway. Odd game plan for Milwaukee for me. I'm sorry. I didn't want to. Shout out to Brook Lopez, though. He got post touches against Miami smaller players and converted 9 of his 10 two-pointers. Shocking to me. At any rate, what questions do you have heading into game 2?
Well, can Miami do it again? Because they're going to need the shooting. They're also going to need Jimmy Butler to do that again. They're going to need Bam Adebayo to be a lot more aggressive to start. Does Milwaukee look to not allow Kevin Love to play if he does play? Does Milwaukee look to take advantage of the early help that Miami was showing? Do we see more drives from them? Do they work to try and make it a little more uncomfortable for Jimmy Butler before he gets into the paint? Like, there's a lot of things that Milwaukee can do better. I think this is a reminder of is Miami could do it. If Jimmy can perform, if Bam can perform, if we can get the driving kick. We get to the fourth quarter, and think about this. Max Strus is running pick and roll. This is no disrespect to Max Strus, but his only job was to take two dribbles and hit the pocket. You could have ran pick and roll in the fourth.
Now, see, that's disrespect. No, I'm just kidding.
So I think if Milwaukee can just get their tempo back up, they hit some more shots, I think this will be a fight of a series. But Miami got one.
Props to Miami, too, without much rest. Again, they just had to play in game on Friday and came right into Milwaukee and got game one. I think for me, aside from what is Milwaukee going to do process-wise offensively, I wonder on the Milwaukee front defensively. If Giannis is back, do they press the Giannis on Jimmy button? Do we just say, hey, Giannis, you get Jimmy, you duck under these screens, or if all else fails, you're involving Bam as a screener, let's just switch this. We're going to keep a big body in front of you, force you to finish over the top. And that kind of ties into your earlier point about Jimmy and the drives against Brook. He won a lot of those battles. Brook also got some really good contests and some blocks in those battles as well. Like, that was very much a heavyweight fight. Do you just push that to the table? Like, hey, we're not letting you do that anymore. And if you do, you have to have the greatest jump shooting slash finishing game of your career to do it. And then you got to do it two more times if you win. That's kind of where I land on that front. And then for Miami, it's a very general thing since Tyler Hero's out. Is Duncan Robinson ready to just get back to the DHOs of the 2020 season? Can he hit enough notes offensively? Can he hold up defensively? Because the Bucks aren't stocked. They aren't stocked with like a bunch of drivers, but Duncan does get handsy when trying to contain on the perimeter. Can he stay on the floor long enough to have the impact offensively? Because they're going to need the movement shooting with no Hero. So that's just, that's mostly where I land. Let's go out west to the Clippers, getting a game one victory over the Phoenix Suns, 115-110. Kawhi Leonard with 38-5-5 in this one, outdueling Kevin Durant, who had 27-9-11 of his own. Steve, what was your big takeaway from this one?
Kawhi Leonard is an insane person. And again, the Clippers defense and their whole team setup is built for this time of year. Mm-hmm. This is where they thrive. This is where it looks a lot better. And I think you got to appreciate what they did defensively. Go watch the effort of Russell Westbrook.
What a game.
Of Terrence Mann, of Nick Batum. Like the little things they did. And even just like taking a second and looking, how many ways did they try and flip these matchups to keep Phoenix off balance? Hey, yeah, Kawhi, you guard DeAndre Ayton. Zubac, you guard Torrey Craig. Huh. Let's show early help. Let's navigate all these screens. Let's recover. That's what stood out to me. And then Kawhi Leonard just doing the thing over and over again. What's that?
Yeah, man. We were on the same page. What I had written down was like, hey, the Clippers bought down Phoenix's half court offense. They had a 92.9 offensive rating in the half court in that game, which is well below where they've been since Kevin Durant arrived. And especially with their big four on the court with Chris Paul, Devin Booker, KD, and Ayton. I love the way that they flipped the matchups in this game. And not only did they go, like, cool, we're going to go Kawhi on Ayton, et cetera. Like, we're just going to time outcomes. We're going to switch that again. We're going to flip that again. Okay, Zubac, you get the regular matchup this time. Kawhi, you're on Torrey Craig. We're going to do this. Aaron Gordon, you take KD this time. Actually, Russ, you take KD this time. Actually, Nick Batum, you get him this time. Chris Paul, you ran a high pick and roll with DeAndre Ayton in the first quarter. They got Russ switched onto him, then he got a dunk. Next time down, it's Nick Batum on Chris Paul this time. No, sir. If this is going to be a switch, we got a bigger man on DeAndre Ayton now. They just pressed the right notes. And I think zooming out, we have been wondering, like, hey, what is the fifth for Phoenix going to look like? And game one is where it really stood like, oh, this is really important for them to nail who the fifth person in this lineup is going to be. Because between putting Zubac on Torrey Craig and just what happened otherwise when Craig wasn't in that spot, like it wasn't a lot of minutes for Josh Okogie. Ish Wainwright had a spell, missed the crucial corner three in the fourth quarter. They tried Terrence Ross and God bless him. The defense just was not there. A lot of Landry Shamet for Phoenix, which like fine. But like I think they missed campaign not being able to have him in that game one to provide some kind of secondary creation off the bench. The second unit gap, I think, is really what stood out for me in this one.
No, I hear you there. I think that may be something that helped the Clippers were helped by. You know, obviously you miss Paul George, but things are simplified. Everyone knows what their role is. Everyone knows what their minutes are going to be. They know what they got to come in and do. So it's huge. Do you want to talk about Chris Paul?
I think we should talk about Chris Paul.
So I've asked this before, and I will continue to ask it. What are the Suns going to do when Chris Paul's put in action? Because my friend, my pal. Mm-hmm. Didn't go so great.
Was not ideal. So feather in the cap for you there, sir. I'll say offensively is where I felt a little bit weird with Chris Paul as well. Again, the Clippers did a lot of dictating in that regard. Like, we're going to flip these matchups so you're just not going to see a bunch of drop. But even when he saw it, one, credit again to the Clippers, their guards just fought, man. Their recovery from their guards was very good. The screen navigation was good on the zone, but even when they got hit, when Russell Westbrook got that assignment, he got right back into it. Norman Powell, he got right back into it. Terrence Mann, he got right back into it, especially in the fourth quarter. So Chris didn't even really feel, it didn't look like he was very comfortable even snaking, getting to the elbow area. That's one thing. And then when he was spaced, the fact that the Clippers felt a little comfort, like, yeah, we can help off of him. Not because Chris can't shoot, but because one, we don't know if he will. And two, just generally, like, it's not the fastest shot release either. So if they're running something with KD or something with Devin Booker, not only are we helping off of whoever their fifth is, if they try to say, let's do this, let's make sure Aiden's rolling towards Chris Paul or whatever the case may be. Now we can show some help too. And that's where I'm like, hey, that can't be the case in game two. There has to be a level of aggression that Chris hits now, especially since it's the postseason.
I think it's going to be interesting if we're talking game two. I think part of it with what the Clippers did to flip matchups, Phoenix is a very heavy execution team. Like, I know they have the bucket getting, they have mid-range, but they are a, we know what you're about to do. We're going to put you in positions where you don't feel comfortable doing it. They never fully got there in game one to me. And they still had an incredible run where it was like, oh, here comes Phoenix.
Yep. To lead in the third.
You got to think about that. I think the closest they got was maybe when they were able to get Plumlee or Zubac in pick and roll, but they still kind of held up. So that's where I'm like, okay, what button does Phoenix think they should hit? How are you going to get DeAndre Ayton involved? I mean, because Torrey Craig actually did a good job as a screener and roller.
Yeah, and he had 22 in this game.
Yeah, so I mean, it's they still were able to find pieces, but it's not necessarily what they want to do. Can you get Kevin Durant more involved down the stretch? Do you know where you want to go down the stretch? Can you get your people involved down the stretch? It kind of felt like they defaulted to what they'd done before, and it's like, hey, man, that guy's pretty good.
That's KD.
But then again, it's like, okay, if KD screens for Chris Paul because of the size they have, that's a switch. And now are they just helping? Are they doubling? Do you feel comfortable about it? Like, I think there's notes for them to hit that they didn't get to.
Mm-hmm. And I would just say generally, like, even in this game, and the Clippers absolutely won it, the Clippers absolutely outplayed Phoenix. We saw in that third quarter, oh, they can hit the notes and just flip this very quickly. And for Phoenix to have the first half that they did offensively, and to even make this a clutch affair kind of speaks to, again, how quickly they can flip it. And even when their guys aren't playing the best, it's still a lot of firepower to deal with. And I guess just zooming out just as a basketball fan, just watching KD and Kawhi Leonard go back and forth in that fourth and watching KD defending those, watching Kawhi defend those KD pick and rolls and getting into a straight, like that's just good stuff.
Can we just give a quick tip of the cap to Kawhi Leonard? Not just for the shot making, not for the casual nature of the shot making, the passing.
Yes.
He just did not care about much of what the defense was trying to do, and his ability to force help and make the right read, get the Clippers to attack a scrambling defense, help them make plays, I thought that was key.
Very key indeed. And while we're just doing quick hat tips, Russell Westbrook, what a game. What a game. Big play after big play, particularly in that fourth. Not just the defense, but also the timely rebounding from him. Go ahead.
You said that?
I did indeed say that, yeah.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah, that was some good stuff from Russ. Very much appreciated what he did there. What would you like to see differently heading into game two? It can be for either team.
Ooh, I would like to see Phoenix have more of a purpose with their tempo in the half court, if that makes sense. They could hit the notes at some points. I think you need to get Devin Booker in rhythm. I think the Clippers threw different things at him, different matchups, different looks. Do you know what you want to attack? I guess is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that stands out to you?
I think trying to flip the matchups back on the Clippers is kind of what stands out to me on the Phoenix side. Like, okay, if you're going to cross match like this, find the guy and then flow into your pick and roll with Aiden if that's what you want to do. Because I think ultimately, if Zubac is on the floor, if Mason Plumlee's on the floor, that's where you're going to get dropped, or that's where you're going to get at the level and dropping back. And so if the Clippers are trying to flip that by putting size on Chris Paul or putting size on Devin Booker or whatever, find a Spalls guy on the floor, run some off-ball action, get that guy switched, because they're going to switch that and then flow into it. And that kind of ties into your point. The tempo has to be there. You can't walk the ball up the floor and then try to do that and then try to run your action, because if it doesn't work, you're late in the clock. And if the Clippers are able to get out and run, they're going to have some fun with that. And so that's kind of the big thing that stands out for me in that regard. And then just in general, like I said a little bit earlier, but they just need more aggression from Chris Paul. And some of that is going to be help getting him more favorable matchups offensively to make that easier. But he also has to have the willing shooter. Like, 8 shot attempts is just not going to be enough for him, to be frank about it. Let's close with the Minnesota Timberwolves losing by nearly 30 to the Denver Nuggets. 109-80 in that one, 24-8-8 for Jamal Murray. A somewhat quiet game for Jokic. 13 points, 14 boards, 6 assists in that one. What stood out to you?
What stood out to me was that Denver was able to play multiple coverages with Jokic defensively. He was able to be in drop comfortably. That stood out to me in a big way. Mm-hmm. So if he's able to mix in, hey, I'm at the level, and hey, I'm in drop, that's tough. That gives Denver comfort. I think the toughest part for me is just the fact that, and I thought Minnesota did some good things as far as Mike Conley looking to get the automatic pocket pass to Kyle Anderson. But if Minnesota can't score, this series will not go very long. And I know that seems very obvious considering you need to score the most points in basketball, but flow-wise, you're giving Denver way too much room for error. So if Jokic is comfortable mixing his coverages and Denver's able to get stops and run, it's very tough. I would like to see the balance of Karl Anthony Towns going forward. At the start of that game, it felt like he was patient against the switches. He was catching, getting to his spot, going over, and then it kind of felt like a lot of three-pointers. So can he find the balance there? Because Minnesota can't afford to not have him going.
What I had in my notes was, and I quote, Minnesota wasn't able to really establish anything. It's kind of where I landed. And that, again, ties into Denver being able to mix in coverages. The fact that it wasn't a big, oh my goodness, the ball is pinging because Jokic is at the level. Like, no, they were able to run some drop with him. They got to the level. They were able to help elsewhere. I kind of worry about the Nickeil Alexander Walker minutes. Like, I don't even think he was bad per se. I think the defense was fine. Jamal Murray was still able to get the better of him, but like the defense was mostly fine. I worry about him offensively because I don't think Denver treats him as like a scary threat out there. And I think when you combine that with, oh, cool, Cat's in the action, we're just going to switch that. Combined with, hey, Rudy Gobert, depending on who the handler is, we don't know if he's going to get the ball. And two, we feel like we can contest at the rim, especially if we're in a drop. You got too many things working against yourself if you're Minnesota. And so that really stood out to me. How many Conley Gobert pick and rolls do you think we got in that game?
12?
8 per second spectrum.
Oh, that's close.
Yeah, like that's not a lot considering like that's generally going to be your drop point depending on the lineups. Like that, they had Jokic on Gobert, they had Aaron Gordon on Cat, and again, a lot of those Cat actions were switches anyway. That's going to be your point. And also part of the reason why you brought Conley in is to help get big fella involved. I'm not saying build the boat out of that ball screen cover, out of that ball screen pairing, because obviously you have Anthony Edwards. But like, you're going to need more than, you know, 6 or 8 between those two, considering how comfortable Denver looked defensively. So I wasn't a big fan of that one. What would you like to see heading into game 2 for Minnesota? Is this just play better, or do you see any kind of shifts that you would like for them to make?
I'd like to see more purpose for Anthony Edwards and Karl Anthony Towns. Get them the ball in different spots. Get them the ball in spots where they can operate and put pressure on Denver's defense. See if you can open those two up. Throw in Mike Conley's playmaking and see what you got offensively. I think if their offense shows up, the game maybe looks a little bit different. And now Denver really has to execute in the half court. Those non-Jokic lineups have to do a little bit more, even though it's not going to be a lot of those minutes. I think if their offense is able to bring more to the table, they give themselves a bigger path.
I got you. And for me, it's like it's similar to the Phoenix ordeal where like, hey, these are going to be some switches. Let's run some off-ball stuff to get a guy that they don't want in the action and then try to create an opening from there. I think that could be a way to open up Anthony Edwards. That could be a way to open up Mike Conley. Like they should probably be pressing the Jamal Murray button as much as they can to try to get some things going there. Or again, if there are going to be some switches between whoever Aaron Gordon's guarding, it's going to be Cat. Let's see if we can get Michael Porter Jr. switched on to Cat and then go from there. And so even if it does become a drive situation for Cat, I feel a little bit better about him driving against MPJ versus Aaron Gordon. Like, I think that's where you go there. And for Denver, like, I don't really, not too much to say there. Like, it felt like there was some fun possessions in the first quarter for Jokic, but it didn't feel like he was working super hard in that one. And so I guess they could always just press the, yeah, we just run more action through him button if a game is closer than it was in game one. But mostly gold marks for me on the Denver side. And with that, I'd like to say thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter if you have not already. Join us for some watch parties. We've been watching the playoff games and the play-in games when they were happening, but we're having a lot of fun in there. Plenty of analysis, some antics. If you want to watch us on YouTube, you will be able to do so. Subscribe to JJ Redick's YouTube channel. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
This man's in shambles like me about charges.